Special funding for the podcast of On Point is provided by Boston University School of Law, dedicated to excellence in teaching and to preparing lawyers for global challenges.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is a special edition of On Point before a live audience at 60 State Street in Boston. To our guests in the hall and listeners around the country, welcome to On Point. My guest, Elizabeth Warren, grew up tough, rough, and ready in Norman, Oklahoma, a janitor's daughter with three older brothers. She was a scrapper, a champion debater in high school who's now grown into a straight-up and fierce champion for America's middle class. In the struggle over reform of American finance, of Wall Street, Elizabeth Warren is front and center, maybe the most uncompromising advocate of regular Americans. Now, whatever reform we're going to get is imminent. This hour On Point, Elizabeth Warren on the American middle class, Wall Street, and reform. We are recording this special show before a live audience at the State Room in downtown Boston. We'll be taking questions from our audience here and from our national audience, which has chipped in with questions at our website, onpointradio.org, and our Facebook page, On Point Radio. Joining me right now is Elizabeth Warren, chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel created to monitor the great U.S. banking bailout, or TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program. She has done that and more with a vengeance. She's been the prime advocate for the creation of a new consumer financial protection agency being hammered out by House and Senate negotiators who are this week coming into conference committee to begin working out a final bill for finance reform. She's a professor at Harvard Law School, a specialist in bankruptcy law, and she's all over the cover of Time magazine lately. Please join me in welcoming Elizabeth Warren. Thank you. Elizabeth Warren, thank you very much for being with us. We couldn't be sitting down at a more opportune moment. It is this week, probably Thursday, that the conference committee gets together. The House and Senate, as everybody knows, have both passed versions of reform of Wall Street, finance reform in this country. Now, no one knows what the final bill is going to be that comes out of there, but we've got a pretty darn good idea of the parameters, I guess, from what they've already passed in each House of Congress. Do you think we are on track to get a reform package that will put us in a significantly different place from where we were before, that will put us in a place where we don't repeat what we've just been through?
I think we're in a place where that could happen, but not a place where it's guaranteed to happen.
If it's not guaranteed at this point, they're going into conference committee. They've got the raw material. They're not going to get – are they going to get new brainwaves in there?
No, but what they are going to get are even more lobbyists.
You're not giving us comfort yet.
No. Because there shouldn't be any comfort, because as soon as you think there's comfort and we all say, ah, this is great, let's all lean back just a little bit, believe me, somebody who is making a whole lot of money is going to slip into that gap, and they're going to get one line changed, and they're going to get one little provision dropped, and they're going to get one more piece compromised out. And at the end of the day, we can all congratulate ourselves that we got something that has the right title and has no real impact.
We want to talk about what might happen there and what might not happen. Let's go a little bit piece by piece, if we may, and let's start with the piece that you have championed most personally yourself. And it is in there, at least in title, Consumer Protection Agency. It's in both versions. We assume it's going to be in the final bill. But I've read you saying recently, you know, that it's got dings in it, and you told General Sarah at the New York Times, if it's weakened any further, then it becomes a waste of time. What's there, what's not there, what's going to determine whether or not Elizabeth Warren says waste of time?
Okay, so here's where we are in this consumer agency. There's somewhat different versions in the House and the Senate, and we're in a classic, I've never seen anything like this. If you pick all of the best parts of the version from the House and the version from the Senate, you got a really good bill. If you pick all of the worst parts from the House version and the Senate version, walk out, because it's not worth it at that point. So this really is, there are key points. And let me give you a couple of examples.
Please.
So what are the kinds of things you want? Well, you want to see a bill that has complete coverage. The whole idea behind it is that products will be regulated the same regardless of who issues them. Can you believe? I mean, part of what got us into this problem is that mortgages would be treated differently based on whether they were issued by a nationally chartered bank, a state chartered bank, or a mortgage broker that didn't take any deposits at all. It's craziness. So right now, one of the big questions is, will auto dealers be able to exempt car loans that they originate and then sell into commerce from the application of this committee?
There's been a lot of pressure not to include them in this, and they know how to pound on their congressman.
No kidding. And here's what's been amazing. I have to say, nobody's really gotten out the door yet except the auto lenders. The auto lenders right now are the only ones who really have the big everybody else but not us. And the thing that makes this one really, really worrisome is that, okay, same product, a credit union and an auto dealer put out the same thing, car loans. But the auto dealer says, I don't have to stick with that same set of rules. I don't have to have the same kind of limitations. And let me tell you why that might just matter. For anyone who understands what happened in the mortgage brokerage industry, there's something called a yield spread premium. And basically all it meant was that mortgage brokers could take money in order to sell worse products to their customers. And the worse the product was, the more money that went to the mortgage broker. Car dealers do the same thing. So they have, they get kickbacks. I'm sorry. That's the only word I know for it.
But is this one make or break for the middle class? So a mortgage can make or break a family. A car loan?
Second biggest purchase that middle class families make is a car loan. It's somewhere between $1,000 and $3,800 per loan. That's the size of the kickback for the car dealers who want to do it. Now, look, car dealers by itself, is that a laydown? Am I going to sit here and say yes or no? I'm not going to say, because we're all in the middle of how this one negotiates out. But what I want you to understand is this is the kind of thing you're looking for. It's the sort of deal where somebody comes in, this intense group, they call every congressman, they call every senator, they say, we need an great, let everybody else get regulated, just not us. This is where you got to keep holding the edges. Who else is doing that? Pounding on the door, the payday lenders. It's the great groups that are doing this.
Super high interest rates to get to make it through
payday. So you got that kind of thing. You've got a question about whether or not this agency, unlike all other agencies, is going to have the possibility that there'll be vetoes. That is, that the other bank regulators who've been such very, very good friends of the financial institutions and not of customers, will they get a veto?
I'm reading that they do. The Office of the Comptroller of the Concurrency can preempt state loans, that you're going to have a committee of bank regulators to veto any decision by your consumer agency?
So that's going to be one of the questions on the table. Do they get a veto at all? And if they do, how big a veto is it? I mean, in other words, is it a two-thirds standard, all of the regulators getting together? Is it one regulator alone who gets to do it? Is the standard just because they don't like it, or is the standard because it's going to bring down the entire financial services industry? The reason I say this sort of thing is this is where I want to pause for a minute, because I go on in great detail about these pieces. This really is when you wade into the weeds on this bill. And so there are big principles here. Does it cover everyone? Is it going to have genuine independence? Is it going to have enough cops on the beat? Will it be able to have a budget that it doesn't have to go out and fight every single year with the financial services industry to keep Congress from smothering it?
Does it cover enough of the finance world? I mean, I read you tell us that 98% of the nation's banks, every bank with assets under $10 billion, would be exempt from its oversight?
Not quite.
Okay.
The way that one reads is the rulemaking authority is 100%. And then the question
is,
who has first-line authority to enforce? And there's been a big fight back and forth about whether or not the bank regulators are the first-line enforcement, or is the consumer agency.
Okay.
And the House version says, because here again, community banks have really been pounded on the doors, the House version says the first-line authority can be with the bank supervisors, not with the agency, but the agency has backup authority. If it ever gets a consumer complaint about a bank, it can move in.
Is that an effective position to be in? You're sort of on the other side of a wall from the action.
So let me ask it this way. Is it the best position to be in? Absolutely not. Is it a position you might be able to work with? We're down at the weeds level. And the answer is you might. This is really, that's why I said when you ask me where are we, the answer is it is all up in the air right now.
Barack Obama, Christopher Dodd, Barney Frank, all in the middle of this, they're all going to want you to say, I bless this. This is a good bill for the American middle class.
You know, I hope they give a bill that I can say, God bless this and everybody else, because that's how I hope this works out. But you got to understand, just once in a while, there have to be independent voices that are really willing to say, I'm sorry, you guys labored hard and brought forth a mouse. This one doesn't work.
You said go for the whole thing, fight. You'd better go down fighting for the right thing than to go for something watered down. You said leave blood and teeth on the floor. Do you see the Obama administration, the Democrats who have led this charge, prepared to do that? Or is it, let's cut a deal, put up the flag that we did it, you know, let this puff of smoke go up and slap ourselves in the back?
Well, look, remember where we started this. Both the House version and the Senate version are really workable. Either one of them could work. That's why I said we have the opportunity to make this work. In other words, what we, and I really mean we here, because this one was the American people. This is the fact that the media got involved. We patrolled the boundaries on this one. This was such an obvious bill to say, first, the lobbyists said they would kill it outright. Okay, when that didn't work, shoot. Then just take a piece out here and take a piece out there and take a piece out there till there's nothing there. Neither the House nor the Senate did that. Neither one produced a perfect bill, but neither
one... It's not gutted.
It is not. And now we're down to the question, because there are enough different permutations, enough different ways to add up the two bills, you could end up with something that's a complete waste of time.
You've been so out front. Do you feel some leverage going into this home stretch? President Obama wants something by the end of this month.
You know, here's the part that really amazes me. People say, oh, nobody watches what goes on in Washington. Everyone's tired of this. Why do you think these bills have gotten stronger over time? It's because people care. The leverage is coming from America right now.
Consumer champion Elizabeth Warren is with us this hour. We're talking about fixing American finance and Wall Street reform in a special edition of On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook before a live audience of public radio supporters in Boston, and this is On Point. My guest this hour is consumer champion Elizabeth Warren. We're talking about fixing American finance and Wall Street reform. It couldn't be hotter. The conference committee sitting down for its first meeting this week, probably Thursday, in Washington, to hammer out some compromise between House and Senate bills that are already on the table. Rahm Emanuel has called over to Capitol Hill, says they want something in hand by June 24th when the president goes to a big international economics meeting. They'd like to have that leverage. Elizabeth Warren has been in the middle of everything that's happened as the economy came down and in all the efforts to build it back up and find a new regulatory footing on the way there. She's chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel created to monitor the U.S. banking bailout. Since 2007, she's been a big advocate for a new Consumer Financial Protection Agency. Language that would create that is in both House and Senate bills, but exactly what we get there remains to be seen. The New York Times has called her the scourge of Wall Street. Wall Street is, maybe they need a scourge, but they don't like it. The Time magazine calls her a sheriff of Wall Street, along with FDIC Chief Sheila Bair and SEC Chief Mary Shapiro. That would be Elizabeth, Sheila, and Mary, the sheriffs of Wall Street. We'll talk about gender in this whole business. Newsweek's called her the closest thing ordinary Americans have to a people's voice. And as daughter of a maintenance man, that may not be surprising. We'll talk about some of the personal background that Elizabeth Warren brings to this as well. Our friend economist Simon Johnson says that when you hear people saying that this regulatory reform is going to be the biggest thing since the 1930s, since the Great Depression, he says, don't get too excited. There hasn't really been any reform since the Great Depression. So that is too low a bar. We've talked some about the Consumer Protection Agency that you've championed, but there's a lot that you've been paying attention to beyond that on the table as well. Let's talk for just a minute about the ratings agencies. You know, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, Fitch, they give all these, you know, multi-star ratings to stuff that turned out to be junk. Is that going to be fixed? Is there a chance of that being fixed? And what's coming out of the conference committee?
Yeah, there's a chance. I think the thing that surprises me, one of the things that surprises me substantively, if we'd been here a year ago and we'd had a big chalkboard and we'd been kind of figuring out what we think the thing would look like by the time it got to the end, I would have figured center of the Crosshairs would have been the rating agencies, mm-hmm. because the rating agencies were, we just know, they didn't just fail, they failed profoundly. Mm-hmm. And they failed, let's all remember on the rating agencies, it's not just some private group, they have the effect of law. You know, there are, my husband teaches trust law. You can't, trusts are only allowed to purchase certain kinds of instruments that have certain
nationally
kinds of
recognized
ratings.
Statistical rating organizations.
That's exactly right.
You know,
that's exactly right. And yet, the ratings agencies have gotten off surprisingly lightly. And it's only been, and this is what's interesting, last-minute amendments into the Senate bill. Again, when you sort of have felt this pushback from the rest of America saying to Washington, you must do more, that we've started seeing some options on rating agencies. So I'm going to put it this way. It's possible there will be changes. Whether or not they're going to be big enough changes, I can't even say.
That's like such a long shot. And we know that a lot of people in the financial services industry, and, you know, may they do well because a whole lot of 401ks are wound up with them. But money market and pension fund managers take a certain comfort from the ratings agencies, even when they're not working right, because it gives them cover if things go wrong.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I mean about the legal implications of this. And it's so deeply woven into our system now. And I will say, that it's trying to talk about things like, for example, some liability for these agencies if it turns out that they have engaged in really slipshod rating practices, and I think that's appropriate. But this one's thin. This one's thin.
That sounds like another long shot, some big ifs hanging over this package. Let's talk about another very important mm-hmm. piece, derivative regulation. None of us knew what derivatives were. Maybe we heard it in a college English class 1,000 years ago, but we know now that they were leveraged into a whole lot of hellacious trouble right. in the downturn. Now, credit default swaps, as I understand, there's not really a handle on them. There are going to be exchanges for more transparency here, but not for the stuff that brought us the worst problems, most likely, in the meltdown. What about that? If we're still going to have all the sort of derivatives action out there that really matters, under the covers, out of sight, nobody knows, it's very profitable, we know that. If it's not reined in, are we out of the woods?
God, this is the hard part. I mean, the notion of trying to bring some of this out into sunlight, even the parts that they've started with and that are in the bill about trying to move it out, you've seen the ferocious debate over the trying to keep this stuff hidden. And what really, really worries me here is that not only have we not gone far enough there's no chance we're going far enough in this bill
on
derivatives. There's just no chance. The steps we are proposing, though, here, that the Congress is proposing here, they're good steps. Don't get me wrong, because I think this is the needle you have to thread. Virtually everything in this bill makes the world somewhat better. I mean, I'm going to leave aside the consumer, because that one really is. It's an on-off switch for me on the consumer. But on the rest of this, most of it moves in the right direction. The point is, it's not moving far enough yet. So what's your view on this? Do we only get one bite at the apple? Is this the only time we ever do this? Or is the message that the American people wanted more of this? That's why the Senate bill is better than the House bill. Barney Frank, God bless
because
him,
pressure
said,
grew.
That's right. He said, if I could be passing my bill now, my bill would be stronger, mm-hmm. right? That in general, the Senate bill got much stronger than the House bill on all of the Wall Street provisions. Will we take this bite and in effect say, okay, that now sets the floor, and we got to turn around and come back and take another bite and another bite and another bite? Or is this going to be a case of saying, you know, we dust our hands off and say it's all over? So I think there are two important moments coming up. And the first one is what really comes out here. What pieces match? How much do we get out of it? How much strength do we get out of it? But it really is, do we have the pressure? Do we care enough? Are we still intently enough focused on this that we can gear up and take another bite at this? I just don't think it's a one-time solution. And I want to remind everybody, FDR didn't do this in one bite. He made significant changes. Simon Johnson, quite rightly, compares what's happening here to what happened during the Great Depression. But Simon Johnson also reminds us, FDR kept enacting and enacting and enacting. He was still doing regulatory reform in 1940.
I've got a quote here from the chief lobbyist for the Financial Services Roundtable. This is Scott Talbot. He says, and this was last November, the time for pitchforks and torches is over.
Ghost.
Over.
How's that working for you?
Well, maybe pretty well. I mean, But you're suggesting this may be a two-step or a three-step or a four-step mm-hmm. process.
If the financial services industry thinks that they can continue to fight right down to the wire, inch by inch, right? And that's what they're doing. That's what they're doing right now in conference. They've got all of the lobbyists out working all the time. And it is a thunderous a cacophony that the way they are hammering on Washington about this. If they think, though, that this is the end, that whatever it is, they fight it down to this, and now it's done, and everyone kisses and makes up with Wall Street, they're wrong.
They may be wrong. I want to talk about the sausage making, if we may. And this comes down to another huge piece of the reform package around too big to fail. What happens when there is a bailout? Will there be more bailouts? Before we even get to the lobbyists, the administration itself, here, this is just from some, we're going to hear a little clip of tape from about 10 days ago. This was a congressional oversight panel hearing, Elizabeth Warren chairing. And here's a bit where you are grilling U.S. Treasury Department's Chief Restructuring Officer, Jim Milstein, about the American taxpayer, whether the American taxpayer, and listen to the back and forth, this is the law professor pulling teeth here, whether the American taxpayer would be repaid for the AIG bailout.
I think you can say with confidence as an oversight panel that the Federal Reserve is going to be paid in full. You can say that the... Wait. You can say that... It was a comma, not a period. You can say that... That an analyst, a well-respected analyst, came into your hearing and said that basically the ENF is going to be paid in full and that the government Series C is worth something.
But there will be losses,
no,
according to the
ENF. No, that's not what this gentleman is telling you.
He thinks we're going to get paid in full.
That's if
and that the CBO
if
estimate
the
is simply wrong.
If he believes the stock has a positive value of $5, that means that what I'm trying to recover is going to get recovered.
Because we're going to be paid in full. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Milstein.
Like you believe that for a second from the tone of what you're saying there. And he's in the Treasury Department. This isn't a financial industry analyst. I mean, is that the end of that? You're just going to take that? It doesn't sound like much of an assurance, and you don't sound like you believe it.
He's on the record now.
Okay. So checkbox.
Yeah. And we have
the law.
We have a 240-page report coming out on Thursday.
But he doesn't personally have $100 billion in his back pocket, even though he's on the record.
No, he doesn't have $100 billion in his back pocket. You know, this is one of the most frustrating parts of this whole process. We push, we pull, we press when we're doing congressional oversight. This is mm-hmm. oversight of TARP.
Right.
It's on behalf of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
We're not overseeing Congress. And... we do the best we can with the numbers. There are people who want to give us secret numbers, and we don't want secret numbers. We want it all out because the whole point is what you better understand when you talk to us. It's out there for anybody to see and anybody to make whatever they want to.
They want to give you secret numbers because they'd like to keep it all kind of in the clubhouse.
That's exactly
even
right.
This administration has publicly voiced its complaints about you, saying your critiques are too unvarnished. They're too public. They're too plain spoken, Elizabeth Warren.
That's the way it has to be. I mean, you know,
But what does Rahm Emanuel call you and read you the riot act about, cut it out. You're pounding on your own side here. I mean, after all, Democrats appointed you. Presumably, Democrats could take you out of this position of chairman. Though you've built kind of a big tower for yourself.
No one calls me and tells me to stop doing this.
I'm not going to.
Good. No, but it's important to hear that. It is important to hear that. I understand. This is part of what do you learn about Washington when you go there. I have come to learn that the way people tell me that I'm not doing what I should be doing is they get quoted in a newspaper article
mm-hmm.
or they get
mm-hmm.
quoted in the press or there's just unnamed sources who get quoted on the, well, many on the Hill thing.
Mm-hmm. She's off the reservation. She's the Joan of Arc, you know. She's crusading.
But my view is my phone number is public. If you want to call and talk to me, then call and talk to me. But you better understand just what I said before. I don't take secret numbers, and I don't take secret phone calls. So if you want to call and talk to me, then you better understand that you're talking to a whole lot of people potentially here. And it's your deal. Call me anytime.
Be ready for that conversation. It can be tough. One of Elizabeth Warren's students is quoted calling her style in the classroom Socratic with a machine gun. There's a question.
That was meant lovingly.
I'm sure that was. That sounds very loving. We've got a lot of questions here from our audience and from around the country. Here we go from David. If a TARP or bailout is needed again, will the money come from an industry-sponsored account or the taxpayer? Good question. Simple.
So the way I see this is if it comes from an industry account, especially an industry account that's been set up before, then it is not TARP. That's the whole point. What the problem was with TARP, TARP has two features to it that we always have to keep in mind. One is the notion that we put public money in to bail out private institutions because they were in trouble and because our whole economy was in trouble at that moment. Our markets were in trouble. I understand that. But the second was the terms on which we did that. And the terms on which we did TARP were basically, take our money, please. The shareholders didn't get wiped out. The debt didn't have to take a haircut. No CEOs had to lose their fancy jobs. The way it's set up, if we get this in regulatory reform, is it says we acknowledge, and I think this is the smart thing, I think you've got to acknowledge this, things could go wrong again. This whole thing could crash and fall apart again, either in the short term or at some long distant point in the future. But that if it does, the next time around, the price to be paid is that the shareholders are wiped out, the debt have to take a haircut on whatever it is that's left there, top management loses its job, and the company that has to turn to the taxpayer for money, whatever it is, it ceases to exist.
I want to ask how hard you had to fight for that. Here's a little tape of you with the Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner. This is last September, and you're asking Secretary Geithner why the U.S. government didn't push for tougher terms in bailing out AIG and TARP in the first place.
We did not have the legal capacity to manage the orderly unwinding of a large, complex financial institution. Capacity we do have for small banks and thrifts, but did not have for an entity like AIG. And that forced us to do things that we would not ever want to do. But
Are you saying that you couldn't find a way to pay less than 100 cents on the dollar there, but since you could find a way in the auto industry?
I mean, we would have done that in a second if we could have done that. But the in deciding that default by AIG would have presented the risk of further systemic damage to a very fragile system, we made the judgment to prevent default.
Timothy Geithner, looking back on TARP under the questioning of Elizabeth Warren, let's take the TARP word out for a second because it's particular, but I think what Americans are really thinking about is taxpayer bailout in general. Does this put a moat between the taxpayers and another bailout threat, another bailout demand?
I think it's moved us in the right direction. That part of what it does is it gives the big notice to large financial institutions or any large institution, look, if the day comes when you have to knock on the taxpayer's door and say, give me money, you better understand you will be gone. That is, the bailout, to the extent there's a bailout, is for all the people who did business with you. It's not for you because you will be gone. That's important because I think if that happens, you run your business differently. That adds some of the market discipline. The part that's scary is the question of whether or not we still back up whole markets. Remember what happened in AIG and what Secretary Geithner just said in that little clip. Don't let that slip by. He said, in effect, we were willing to throw as many taxpayers under the bus as it would take to make that derivatives market pay 100 cents on the dollar. Just like it was your savings passbook insured by the FDIC.
No penalty.
No penalty. They never paid for it. They got the fanciest, best guarantee in the world. Why? Because we live in a world in which the money that's going through banks is only a little piece of the action. And we are deeply, powerfully dependent on that other form of money that we don't regulate.
That other form of money being?
These derivatives, these accounts that are moving back and forth.
It sounds like we're still hostage.
We are.
And we'll be on the other side of this package.
We will be less hostage. This is not
a matter of degree.
This is dimmer switches. This is how vulnerable are we? This vulnerability didn't explode one day. It built up over time. And what's happening is if we get the right reg reform bill here, we move it down some. But don't kid yourself. We don't make it disappear. The magic fairy does not exist here, and we don't have the the pixie dust to spread on this financial system. Oh. That's big systemic reform that's going to take more.
We've got to take a short break. We'll come right back and talk about the role of women in this new era, if indeed it is a new era. Elizabeth Warren is with us. She's chair of the Congressional Oversight Panel created to monitor the U.S. banking bailout. I'm Tom Ashbrook with Elizabeth Warren before a live audience in Boston. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook before a live audience in Boston, and this is a special edition of On Point. My guest is Elizabeth Warren. She's become perhaps the biggest consumer advocate in the United States of America. She is right in the middle of all the negotiations going on over what will be the future of financial industry reform, the reform of Wall Street. It's underway right now. She's been talking about it for a while. Here she is with Michael Moore, the filmmaker, in his 2009 film, Capitalism, A Love Story.
When that much money disappears, it's usually because somebody broke some laws somewhere. But if we don't look, if we don't ask, if we don't uncover it and make it all public, we'll never find out.
Where is the criminal investigation that needs to happen here?
I haven't seen it.
She hasn't seen it. All right, here's a question from our audience for Elizabeth Warren. Question: why can't we have more individuals facing jail time for what they knew was wrong? We don't want Goldman Sachs Inc. sued. We want individuals prosecuted.
So I find this one really interesting. I am old enough to remember the savings and loan crisis. In fact, I lived it down in Texas. Mm-hmm. My husband and I went through three different banks in a row as they were taken over by their various regulators. And the pattern down there was the bank collapse. That meant all the management lost their jobs, thank you very much. The depositors were fully protected. The shareholders were wiped out. Any commercial creditors, many of them got protected, but there were some haircuts in that. And that was what happened when you took them over. And then the next thing that happened were the investigations and the criminal prosecutions in some cases and civil in others. Sometimes it was criminal, sometimes it was civil. So much so, remember I'm a bankruptcy person, The bankruptcy laws were actually amended following this to make it so that when there were civil judgments against officials in banks who got them because of their malfeasance in bringing down their financial institutions, those could not be discharged in bankruptcy. I mean, we were making other adjustments in the law to make sure that they would feel the sting personally of what they had done to the banking system, to our economy, and the risk they had put the American taxpayer.
That was then. What about in this last chapter, and what about now?
You know, it's as if there's been a change. I mean, a fundamental change, a notion that by having raced in and rescued on such staggeringly generous terms, it was as if at that moment we had given a giant blessing to the financial institutions that had brought us to that brink of disaster and said, oh, this was a terrible thing. Nobody could have seen it coming. And everyone was kind of absolved. Nobody looked. And look how the conversation is different. The conversation over and over is, who could have seen a bubble like this? Who could have? Anybody who had their eyes open could have seen it. Not to see it. It stuns me. I cannot believe that rational people are having this conversation about how surprising this was. It was surprising that somehow people who were borrowing 107% of the fake appraised value of their homes might not pay off at the same rate that people were paying off back when they put down 20% down payments on their homes?
That was very lucrative lending until it wasn't.
No kidding. And and the notion that there was just not staggering amounts of risk being sucked into this system. Some rating agency gave it a AAA. Well, I don't care.
Well, maybe this is about whose interests were really being cared about. I mean, people will say nobody should have borrowed that way, and people who did are certainly in trouble. But your big theme is about the American middle class and what we really care about in this country and whether we're attentive enough to the interests of the American middle class. I read you saying we fix this or the game really is over for the American middle class. I mean, is that the shift in those 20, 30 years? Is that the shift that's made people overlook some dangers and accept many others?
No, I think that what's happened over a generation is we've gone from a position early 1970s. Middle class was synonymous, right, with stolid. It should have been a synonym for concrete, right? It was always going to be there. And
now
every
politician
from 1938 until you hit the mid-1970s, late 1970s, wants to do things for the middle class, right? We want to have FHA so everybody can get homes. And it's all about how we can build up a strong and robust middle class. And then there's a shift. And what starts to happen is the middle class becomes the turkey at the Thanksgiving dinner. The middle class is where you look for how to take a piece off here and a piece off there. And the financial services industry, by the way, nobody ever talks about this. In 1979, we knocked just a key pillar of consumer financial protection out of the legal system, and that was usury laws. And it basically said to financial services company, the ones that dealt directly with consumers, it took them a few clicks to figure it out. But this is a great story. The CEO of Citibank flies out in the early 1980s, flies out to South Dakota, and says, if you'll raise your usury rate effectively to the sky, we will move jobs and run our Citibank operations. If you've ever wondered why
that's
it's run
why
out of South Carolina,
out there, yeah.
I mean, South Dakota. That's exactly right. But the point is, what began to shift is the middle class. It was like I hate to use the analogy now, but like an oil reserve to be tapped. Let's just see what we can get out of them. And it happened on credit cards. It happened on mortgages. It happened in every direction. At the same time that this was going on, real wages in the United States just flattened. A fully employed male today makes about $800 less than his father made in the 1970s, adjusted for inflation. Families tried to adjust by sending a second person into the workforce. Mm-hmm. This is the story about
off went mom.
About two incomes. That's exactly right. But the reality was, couldn't make up for the difference in how costs are beginning to shift at the same time. Cost of housing, adjusted for inflation, by 2007, had what a family was spending on a mortgage had gone up by more than 100%. What families were spending on health care had gone up by more than 100% in inflation-adjusted dollars. What they're spending on transportation, what they're spending on, these are big core expenses. Child care, because now they've got two people in the workforce. So the entire economic structure of the middle class shifts across this generation. Flat wages, rising core expenses, and a financial services industry that says, woohoo, this is where we're going to make big bucks.
In other words, they're going to need to borrow to get along.
That's exactly right. They quit saving, spent all of the new income that had come in, and now turn to borrowing, borrowing, borrowing.
So are you saying bring back usury laws?
I'm saying that we've got to find other ways to protect these families. So look, wages are part of it. That's another whole hour that we'll have to do at another time. Rising core expenses on housing, on health care, we're wrestling with this. It's big stuff. But the third one is credit. And that's what the Consumer Financial Protection Agency is about. It's about a modern way to try to say, look, there was a time in America from colonial times, my biblical scholars go back to Deuteronomy, when usury laws were the way you made sure that those with money, the financial institutions, didn't prey on ordinary families. We just had state laws that said, you only go this high. And that meant it wasn't worth it to try to build in a bunch of tricks and fancy stuff because you just tapped out on how much you could charge people. That changed, as I said, basically in 1980. And the whole business model changed. So it changed into pretending that I'm selling you something at 7.9%. But the reality is, by the time we get through with the tricks and the traps and the fancy stuff in the back that you can't see in advance, not only am I selling you something that's vastly more expensive and vastly riskier than you thought, I've also made a market now. The financial services industry has made a market where you can't compare those products with each other. Let's put four credit card agreements on the table here. I can't tell which one's
cheaper. Four card money. Newsweek quotes critics calling you evil, power-hungry, and ignorant lady.
Wow.
Because you talk like that?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I hadn't heard that one.
Yeah. That's,
you
that's,
sure?
That, yeah, that's pretty. That's a pretty high high-octane series. I mean, have you felt the hammer personally in Washington? Here's a question from Judy of these pressures. But Judy says, for you, what was the most difficult part of Ms. Warren's assignment in Washington, and what created and what's her greatest concern moving forward?
So I guess the hardest part, God, there's so many to choose from, but the hardest part is having conversations with people who really don't want to hear what you have to say.
Because they're making a lot of money, they don't want to change, or they think you're evil, power hungry, and ignorant.
They already know the answer. And the answer is just happens to fit with where they get a lot of support somewhere else financially. I got nothing when I walk in. I mean, you have to understand this. I don't walk in with any, I don't have any votes, I don't have any money to give, I just want to talk to people about what's going on. And I think the part that is the hardest is sometimes I will talk to people in Congress. Look, I think most of them, they didn't go to Congress in order to lie, cheat, and steal. I think most of them went because they had some sense somewhere in their hearts at some point about public service. And I talk about what happens to middle-class families, and I watch faces, I watch eyes connect on this that say, yeah, I go back home too, and they name towns across America, and they say people are scared, people are worried, people are out of work. These are the things I hear in the grocery store. These are the things I hear in
the
town hall meetings.
So what's the counterweight to that?
And then I say, okay, look, here are three things we can do. But it's about reining in an incredibly powerful industry. It's about reining in a group that gives money and knows how to exercise power in Washington. And I just watch the light go out because it's not going to happen.
How does that happen exactly? Is it just, you know, a phone call that comes, you're going to have this money for your campaign, or you're not? Is it people screaming at them who have contributed in the past? How's the hammer actually hit them on the top of the head?
You know, I don't know because I'm not in the room when it happens. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you a couple of things that surprised me about it. One of the things that really hit me is the imbalance in information. So it works this way. The lobbyists come by these offices literally every single day to talk about why the Consumer Financial Protection Agency mm-hmm. will kill our business. And there are herds of them that come by. They don't travel alone. They really do. They travel in packs. They're kind of scary when you come down the halls. And they come in groups, and they give reasoned, thoughtful, articulate, intelligent reasons why the guy who's paying me to be here today should have a special exception from the application of this law, or this law should be killed. Why should we?
So they persuade them.
And they go back and they write for these overworked staffers who, God bless them, are trying to do healthcare and financial services mm-hmm. and environmental protection and 50 other things all at the same time. They're these tiny little staffs, relatively speaking, to the size of the problem. And these lobbyists go back and they hire my former students who are working in these big fancy firms,
Harvard Law School,
produce me a memo on, and these memos are beautiful. And they find that one case, they think of that one story, that great hypothetical that illustrates why the rich and powerful client needs just one little exception here. The information asymmetry in this game, I spent the whole summer, last summer, going out one at a time, talking to people. And how do you follow up with that? You got one voice. And look, there's some consumer groups. I want to be fair. Americans for Financial mm-hmm. Reform, God bless. They've put it together. But they've done it with, you know, with $1.85 and a handful of people to try to go in and talk. And in a world in which it's complicated, there's a lot moving on, this imbalance, it doesn't even take dollars to the congressman to make this happen. Of course, that helps too. But it is. The effect of this imbalance in Washington, of the notion that we don't pay staffers enough, we don't give big enough staffs to Congress to be able to do this independent, to be able to do the work of the people
in a hard
and complicated
way. And so industries write legislation.
Way.
Industries
That's
write
exactly
regulation.
Right.
I've got three questions on one theme here. These are a couple from Facebook. Deanna says, clearly we need more people like Elizabeth Warren, yet so few come forward. How did you become she asks, so courageous in your professional life. What can we do to make this trait more common in people who run for elected office? Huh, here's another. Mike, I wish you'd ask Elizabeth if she's interested in running for the Senate for Scott Brown's seat. And here's one more. Julie, from our audience here, says some of your ardent fans would like you to run for president. We sense in you an honest, down-to-earth person who's passionate advocate for the middle and working class, but with government seemingly run by corporations, Wall Street lobbyists, do you think it's possible for you or anyone to break that control? Thank you.
I don't know.
Are you going to run for office?
I'm not running for office.
Definitely never?
I'm not a politician. Do you know how many things I've said?
Yes.
Film at 11 on what this woman's been up to.
The country's not ready for something different? Aren't people ready for calling it like it is?
Look, right now what I want to do is I want to get reg reform through. I want to get a consumer agency in place and launched. I want to make changes that look like real changes.
Does it matter that more women, you among the three on the cover of Time magazine, Mary Shapiro at the SEC, Sheila Bair at the FDIC, does it matter that women have their hands closer to the controls right now and higher controls than ever before?
Well, let's face it, there's still no line in the ladies' room. I mean...
kind of lonely in there?
So it is kind of an interesting question, though, isn't it, that there would be women now in this particular position. My view on this is to get to be a woman, if you're my age and you get to where I am, you're an outsider. And you've either made your peace with that and said, you've already heard all the little snarky and all the, actually more than snarky, you've actually either decided you're going to get tough or die. And because that's what it takes. You just don't have an opportunity to be otherwise. And so maybe that's what it is that causes it to be three women that Time magazine singles out for positions of trying to clean up the mess that we've made on Wall Street.
It's been great to have you here. We've got 30 seconds. What do you think of the odds that we get, or how far down the field, I guess, do we get in this reform package what this country needs to put it on a sound footing?
20-yard line?
20-yard line out of 100?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's good. I think the odds are good that we make real change, that it feels really different. I just cannot say often enough, a strong consumer agency, the possibilities here are transformative. Just telling the banks in these other areas, derivatives and so on, you are not in control anymore. Transformative.
Maybe we'll get 20 yards out of 100. Elizabeth Warren, it's been great having you with us. Thank you so very much for your time today. Thank you. My audience here, thank you very much. This has been a special edition of On Point. Thank you very much for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook for On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.